This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parviskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى مطمئنا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Israeli authorities approve the construction of more than 3,400 settler units in the occupied West Bank. Cuba's president again blames the United States for the anti-government protests in his country as he calls for calm following several days of civil unrest. And also in our headlines, concerns are growing in the U.S. and Europe as the number of coronavirus infections is once again rising. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Israel's new prime minister has relaunched a controversial project for the construction of over 3,400 settler units in the occupied West Bank. The so-called E1 project involves the construction at an unbuilt area of the occupied land. It cuts land access between Palestinian inhabited territories and the West Bank, rendering any future unified Palestinian state unviable. Former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also tried to advance the project, but it was halted under pressure from the international community, the Palestinian Authority, and rights groups. The project is also expected to draw objections from Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's left-wing coalition partners, as well as the U.S. All Israeli settlements on occupied Palestinian land are illegal under international law. Our correspondent Mona Kandil joins us now from Ramallah with more on the recent settlement expansion plan by the Israeli regime. Mona, what details do you have to share with us?
Well, yes, those 3,412 new settler units would be built in the occupied West Bank, mainly in one of the biggest Israeli settlements known as Ma'ale Adumim. These settlements are part of the E1 project that would be linking some West Bank cities with East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, allowing settlers to move freely from the Ma'ale Adumim settlement and the settlements around it to inside Jerusalem, Al-Quds, however, separating Palestinian villages and towns and cities. It would be separating the central of the occupied West Bank from northern the occupied West Bank. And this, of course, would be very difficult for the Palestinians. As you have mentioned, former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had pushed forward for this project. However, it was halted, especially there was this pressure from the international community Now, what's going on is that the new Israeli regime and the new Israeli Prime Minister Bennett had approved the building of those 3,412 units. And this means, according to experts and anti-settlement groups, what we have read this morning, that this might lead to a new conflict or a possible conflict between the American administration and the Israeli regime, because it seems that the U.S. administration is trying to convince the Israelis not to declare about major settlement projects that would be bringing some problems, whether to the Israeli regime and to the Israeli Prime Minister Bennett himself.
All right, thanks a lot, Monop Kandu, joining us from Roman. The Cuban president has called for peace, harmony, and respect amid anti-government protests across the nation.
To overcome disagreements between all of us, we have to encourage each other to try and find solutions, even if we sometimes have different points of view on certain issues or different situations.
Miguel Diaz-Canel once again blamed the United States for the anti-government protests over the economic downturn in his country. Havana says the economic crisis has been caused by half a century of Washington sanctions and embargo. Meanwhile, Cuba restored internet access and temporarily lifted restrictions on the amount of food and medicine that travelers could bring into the country. The moves were an apparent concession to demands by protesters who took to the street last weekend. One person has died and more than 100 have been arrested in the anti-government protests so far. Writer and anti-imperialist activist Bambose Shango says Cuban people have stood firm against U.S. sanctions and embargo, as well as plots to bring about a regime change in their country.
The United States have, of course, had an over 60-year embargo on the Cuban people that has stifled their development. Even with this embargo, the Cuban people have been very resilient and have done amazing things that it's hard to perceive how under such a cold-blooded embargo, people are able to even survive. The recent embargo, including the addition of over 400 more strangulations placed on Cuba by the Trump administration and has not been removed by the Biden administration, has caused hunger and suffering, great shortage of everything from food to medicine to gasoline, and the people are under pressure. Of course, the U.S. in its war against Cuba, its regime change war, has used this pressure to stir inside of Cuba controversies that would possibly lead to what they hope would be a change of government.
Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, which was home to the largest U.S. military base over the past 20 years, is now under the control of the Afghan government. The U.S. withdrawal from the base came only after spending billions of dollars and leaving behind thousands of civilian deaths under the pretext of waging war on terror. Amin Alami has visited the base and filed this report for us.
Bagram Air Base in northern Parwan province was known as the main U.S. military headquarter in Afghanistan over the past 20 years. This is why experts have blamed the U.S. for wasting international aids to Afghanistan by building America's largest military base in the country.
The U.S. has built Bagram military base by wasting international aids that were earmarked for modernization of the Afghan National Army and the country's development. The airbase is now vacated without U.S. achieving its goals.
As this army general says, the U.S. forces informed Afghans of their pullout earlier, but set no exact time for their departure.
Early morning, once we received some rumors that U.S. army left the Bagram, we increased our intelligence and our reports. We got that yes, they left the Bagram, and after that we entered to the base and took the old tower, then secure inside of the back room as well.
After talking to the ANA commander, we headed to former symbol of U.S. military power in Afghanistan, Bagram Air Base. A parking lot is located at one of the four entrances of the air base. The U.S. forces have left many of these vehicles behind. Afghan forces say U.S. forces have disabled the electronic systems of these military vehicles instead of disabling the war machine of Taliban.
Now, Afghan officials said they are going to fix such military vehicles to use them in fighting against terrorism across Afghanistan.
After crossing the entrance gate, we faced a real American town where U.S. forces have spent long nights and days despite failing to achieve their major stated goal that was uprooting terrorism here. Now, Afghans are in charge of such mission. Having control over Bagram helps Afghan forces to effectively manage and launch counter-terrorism operations against terrorist groups. It seems that the U.S. forces had access to high technology, emergency protection measures and welfare amenities in different parts of this airfield to reduce the level of harm, particularly the psychological harm that was coming from the Afghan war to U.S. forces. For instance, this gas station had been supplying fuel to hundreds of big generators across the air base. Afghan forces have collected these GEM tools from different GEMs located in Bagram, saying the U.S. forces had access to not only GEMs, but also to cinema and restaurants as well. Despite being equipped with a modern air defense system protecting Bagram Air Base during U.S. military presence here, emergency exitways like this one served as a central part of the base. Meanwhile, there have been hundreds of hideouts like this one built by American troops to protect them against possible Taliban rocket attacks. Visiting residential buildings of the U.S. forces in Bagram is also a need. But the bitter fact is that Afghan forces even do not have access to the codes of some doors of the residential buildings in Bagram. So they have no way but to use things like this chair to keep the doors open.
And here is a residential room that was used by American soldiers in the Bagram military air base.
The presence of meal packages, air conditioner systems, refrigerators, microwaves, internet access and TVs that have been left in residential areas by the U.S. forces once again proves that how big difference was and is between a foreign military soldier and an Afghan soldier. There are also many warehouses like this food warehouse in Bagram. Bagram Hospital is the other destination for us. The modern hospital is dark now and we need to use either torch or our camera light to see what is inside. The flame of Washington's longest war in Afghanistan hospitalized thousands of US soldiers in rooms like this one. These beds, medicines, and medical equipment could save the lives of thousands of wounded U.S. troops. But hundreds of them lost their lives here in Bagram Hospital and never returned back to the U.S. due to severe injuries. And now, with rising insecurity in Afghanistan, only time will tell whether or not the Afghan government can make this strategic air base operational due to shortage of financial resources. Syed Amin Alami, Bagram Air Base in Northern Parwan Province.
Coronavirus infections are on the rise in Europe and the United States with a highly transmissible Delta variant, contributing significantly to the recent surge. Spain has reported more than 43,000 new cases. The Spanish northeastern region of Catalonia, a hotbed of the Delta variant, has now reintroduced restrictions and curfews in an attempt to contain the virus spread. The UK has reported 50 new coronavirus fatalities, the highest daily death tally since April. The number of new daily cases has also topped 30,000 for the seventh day in a row. In the world's worst hit country, the United States, the rate of new cases has been at least, or rather has seen at least, a 10% hike in 46 states. Some states have even seen a 50% jump in the number of infections in the past week. Clashes have erupted between French riot police and anti-vaccination protesters in the capital, Paris. The demonstrators were voicing their anger at President Emmanuel Macron's COVID-19 plan, which will be put in effect next month. The plan will require vaccine certificate, or negative test to grant access to public places, including restaurants and cinemas. A similar protest was held in the Greek capital, Athens. The Greek government announced Tuesday that the people will need to be vaccinated to be granted access to indoor public places. The country has also required all health workers to be inoculated against the virus. The United Nations says the coronavirus pandemic has hampered children's routine vaccinations, leaving millions of them at risk of deadly diseases worldwide. Data published by the World Body shows that some 23 million children did not receive basic childhood vaccines last year, the highest number in over a decade. The figure shows an increase of 3.7 million compared to 2019. The sharp decline is blamed on health services being mainly focused on controlling COVID-19 and parents choosing not to vaccinate their children during the pandemic. The World Health Organization has warned of the spread of vaccine-preventable diseases now. It has described the situation as a perfect storm brewing. Britain has reportedly exported around 3 times the amount of weaponry and military equipment to Saudi Arabia than it previously announced. A recent investigation by Campaign Against Arms Trade shows British officials have used a loophole in the country's so-called transparent export controls. The report says the move intends to hide the real extent of the UK's contribution to the Saudi aggression against Yemen, while authorities claim British ministers signed off £6.7 billion worth of arms sales. The probe says the true figure is likely to be closer to £20 billion. Meanwhile, the UK's Department for International Trade, which approves all arms exports, has not disputed the findings of the study. Saudi Arabia launched a war on Yemen in March 2015. Tens of thousands of people, mostly civilians, have lost their lives since then. Political commentator Michael Springman says Britain claims to be the cradle of democracy, while in fact it's hiding its arms sales to states such as Saudi Arabia.
Well, it's bad publicity for the British and their terrible claim to being the mother of democracies and having the mother of all parliaments, when in fact what they're doing is hiding their sales to terrorist states like Saudi Arabia. The British get away with this by having something called an open export license for weapons. And you can sell weapons over 3 to a 5 year period, but you needn't put the exact amount of the sale down. It can be blank. And this is how they get away with it in typical British perfidy. They say one thing and do another, and they believe that they are clean as the driven snow, when in fact they're dirty as a bunch of coal dust. So it's pure Britishness, and it makes money for Her Majesty's government.
More than 1 million acres of the western U.S. and Canada burst into flames as multiple blazes rage across the region with little sign of letting up. In the U.S. state of Oregon, the so-called bootleg fire has now devoured more than 200,000 acres. Large areas in the neighboring state of California have also been placed on red alert as several conflagrations continued to burn. Forest fires are also gaining ground across the border in Canada, where there's been an unprecedented heat wave recently. One of the main outbreaks covers more than 10,000 acres, and nearly 900 homes have been evacuated. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The supplication on Thursdays.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
At least 1,500 Palestinian residents in Silwan al-Quds are at risk of ethnic cleansing in favor of a Jewish tourist park to be established on the site of their historic neighborhood. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Boxbaum Ryder. This article is published under the heading American Tax Dollars Financing Israeli Regime Tourist Park Atop Historic Palestinian Neighborhood. Stay tuned for more. Roughly 2.5 miles from Sheikh Jarrah, the Palestinian neighborhood that grabbed the world's attention in May, lies Silwan. This neighborhood in occupied East Al-Quds is perched atop the steepest slopes just outside the old city. Houses are tightly compacted and stacked on top of each other as they dip into the valley below. And here, Palestinian residents face the same fate as their brethren in Sheikh Jarrah. The Zionist regime forces raided the Al-Busta neighborhood in Silwan with bulldozers on June 29th, razing a butcher shop and dispersing Palestinian protesters defending their homes with tear gas, stun grenades, batons, and rubber-coated steel bullets. At least 13 people were injured and 6 arrested, including the owner of the butcher shop, Nidal Al-Rajabi, and his sons and brothers. In regard to the recent demolition, Norwegian Refugee Council's Palestine County Director Caroline Ord said in a press release under the 4th Geneva Convention, Israel has an obligation to protect civilians under its occupation and to refrain from destroying private property. Al Rajabi's store was destroyed on the pretext of lacking a building permit. Various human rights organizations involved in the issue state conflicting numbers, but according to Fakhri Abu Diab, spokesman for SEAL 1, 16 buildings in Al-Bustan are also at immediate risk of being torn down. About 1,500 Palestinians live in more than 100 houses in Al-Bustan. On June 7th, two structures, including the butcher shop, received notices from the municipality of Al-Quds to self-demolish their homes within 21 days, or municipality authorities would do so and charge the residents the demolition fees, calculated about $6,000. Amy Cohen, Director of International Relations and Advocacy at Ir Amim, Al-Quds nonprofit, told Min Press News the second structure, a residential unit, has yet to receive a visit from municipality inspectors. According to Ir Amim, 68 homes in Al-Bustan have pending demolition orders so as to execute the Al-Quds municipality's King Garden plan. The municipality outlined the initiative in 2010, stating, "The King's Garden area, Al-Bustan in Arabic, will be developed into a tourist and residential district. Commercial sections, restaurants, and art galleries will be built, turning it into a bustling tourist zone. For the first time, the local residents will have the legitimate right to live in this neighborhood." The development plan has not moved forward since 2010, but the municipality's recent objection to extending the demolition freeze suggests the plan could be reactivated. In February, the Al-Quds municipality filed an objection in the local affairs court against Al-Bustan's residents' request to extend the demolition freeze, arguing the proposed zoning plan for the area doesn't follow proper guidelines and isn't advancing quick enough. In March, the court ruled to extend the demolition freeze until August 15. Negotiations have been ongoing between the municipality and the residents to develop a suitable zoning plan for Al-Bustan since 2005. In 2009, the residence plan was rejected by the municipality in favor of the King's Garden plan. According to Murad Abu Shafi, an Al-Bustan resident who received the demolition order, the municipality told the residents, "This structure plan can't happen in Israel. This might happen in Europe or any Arab country, but not here. Our plan was very modern, and it doesn't fit with the Israeli regime's standards for East Al-Quds," Abu Shafi explained. "The Zionist regime doesn't want us to have a modern neighborhood. They want us always to be below the line." Despite the local court's ruled extension, 20 demolition cases, including the butcher's shop order, were excluded from the freeze due to the Zionist regime Kamenetz law, known as Amendment 116 to Planning and Building Law, which was fully enacted in 2019. This legislation intensifies enforcement against unauthorized construction and allows for little legal intervention in preventing demolitions of structures built after 2017. The amendment has been partially frozen since 2020 amid ongoing discussions with Palestinian parliamentary members in the Israeli regime. In a statement to Mint Press News, the Al-Quds municipality said there is no intention to build a biblical garden in the area. "This is a false claim. The area is designated for gardens and parks for the benefit of local residents of SEAL 1. The vast majority of demolition orders in Al-Bustan are suspended. There are a few demolition orders that the court has recently decided to unfreeze. It should be emphasized that these orders are old and no new orders were issued whatsoever. As to the execution of these orders, the municipality is obliged to act in accordance with the law and with the court rulings. We are still studying the latest ruling profoundly and will decide on our next steps according to the situation on the ground. The municipality noted that Al-Bustan is designated as a green area because of its location near the Kidron River. Jeff Halper, director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, explained that when Israel annexed Is Al-Quds in 1967 following the Six-Day War, it declared the entirety of Is Al-Quds as open green space, meaning the area is frozen for future building. Halper pointed out the hypocrisy of this development policy in how Israel treats settlement building versus Palestinian building, explaining, "Today, more than 100,000 Israelis live in East Al-Quds in these big settlements. But if East Al-Quds was frozen 100% for building, then how did you get all that building for Israelis? The answer is, Israel rezones for Jewish settlements. But when a Palestinian wants to build, Israel says, sorry, this area isn't zoned for residential development, but for open green space. So it's really the use of bureaucracy and law and planning as tools of control." Construction in Al-Bustan was done primarily by Palestinian residents themselves on their own land, but often without the necessary building permits. Er Amims Cohen explained this is mostly owing to a lack of viable zoning plans rather than the municipality's flat-out rejection of building permits. With the absence of an outline plan, residents are precluded from acquiring the permits. You either have a lack of a zoning plan or you have such outdated zoning plans, which are from, say, 30 to 40 years ago, that it's impossible to then receive building permits, and this is a very acute way that the Israeli regime authorities have neglected their municipal responsibility to provide this service. Cohen concluded since 1967, this has been a means to suppress Palestinian building and planning within Palestinian areas. Silwan is located in Holy Basin, an area coveted by religious settlers for its proximity to the Old City and alleged connections to King David. Er David or Elat settler organization runs the City of David National Park in Al-Bustan area. Since 1990s, Elat has sought to transform Silwan into a symbol of Jewish biblical past. Al-Bustan is specifically targeted because it stands as an obstacle to achieving Er David's vision of a biblical paradise. Elat's actions aren't focused solely on building settlements, but also on promoting archaeological excavations, tourist attractions, and parks. According to the Foundation for West Asia Region Peace Process report on Al-Bustan, the settlers' goals became the official policy of the Israeli regimes in 2005, when then Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's regime approved plans to develop the Holy Basin area. In essence, the DNA of Elat's biblical ideology became the DNA of the Israeli regime in and around the Old City, with the regime outsourcing many of its authorities to Elat in order to pursue these objectives. FMEP wrote in its report, the lines between the regime and the settlers became so blurred that they almost disappeared. Odeh, whose family faces displacement in Al-Bustan and in Al-Batan Al-Hawa, another neighborhood in Silwanan settler target, described the deep interconnections between settlers and the Zionist regime, citing as an example that Aryeh King is Al-Quds deputy mayor, but is also a notorious settler leader responsible for displacing Sheikh Jarrah residents. These settler organizations are the people running the regime, Odeh said. They receive full support from the military and any ministry and municipality. Er David isn't just supported by the Israeli regime, but also backed by American money. Er David's sister nonprofit in the U.S., Friends of Er David, secures tax-exempt donations for the organization. According to a January investigation by Mint Press News, Hertog Foundation, Irving I, Moskowitz Foundation, Adelson Family Foundation, Mindel Foundation, Samueli Foundation, Jay and Jeannie Scottstein Foundation, and Jewish Communal Fund have all donated to Friends of Air David. The organization's biggest contributors are the Irving Moskowitz and Adelson Family Foundations. In 2018, the Irving Moskowitz Foundation gave Friends of Air David $1.5 million, and the Adelson Family Foundation contributed about $3 million. The Air David Foundation did not respond to a request for comment.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yugoslavia from a historical standpoint.
Part 1.
Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. Milosevic reigned over what was left of Yugoslavia as it fell apart in the 1990s, surviving crippling UN sanctions, wars in Slovenia, Croatia, and Bosnia, violent Albanian separatism in Kosovo, NATO airstrikes against his country, an ICTY war crimes indictment, and 40 years of marriage with a control freak wife, Milosevic was definitely a force to be reckoned with. Brutal towards his opponents at home and abroad, this banker, who at one time worked in New York City as a representative of the Yugoslav bank Belbanka, where he even met American banker David Rockefeller, seemed to not really care about the economic trends that were spreading in the region. Strobe Talbot, Deputy Secretary of State under U.S. President Bill Clinton and the lead U.S. negotiator during the Kosovo War, said that as nations throughout the region sought to reform their economies, mitigate ethnic tensions, and broaden civil society, Belgrade seemed to delight in continually moving in the opposite direction. It was Yugoslavia's resistance to the broader trends of political and economic reform, not the plight of the Kosovar Albanians, that best explains NATO's war.
As long as Milosevic remains in control, the international community will have little influence over what happens in Belgrade.
Since Milosevic didn't want to give up or share his control over the economy with anyone else, he needed to go. And he needed to go fast. Just like this guy, and 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 many others. But it was 2000, elections in Yugoslavia were just around the corner, and it was Milosevic's turn to go. This is me, protesting against Milosevic in my hometown of Subotica, Yugoslavia in 2000. I was a kid, and all I wanted was for my country to be more open, more accepted in the world community. And I wasn't alone. Since the early 1990s, there were many mass demonstrations against Milosevic, and they were led by opposition leaders such as Vuk Drašković and Zoran Đinđić. Under Milosevic, crime and corruption was around every corner, and many of his policies were extremely damaging for the people. Millions in Yugoslavia thought that if we were friendly towards the West, we'd quickly live just like they do. But to overthrow someone like Milosevic, you needed a serious team to get the job done.
Hello, I'm Marović, Ivan Marović. In 2000, my friends and I brought down Slobodan Milošević.
Make repression work for you. Make craziness the norm. 10,000 people in the street is news. 10 people in the street is obviously not news. But 10 people in the street doing something crazy, now that's news.
This guy made a revolution happen? You've got to be kidding me. There had to have been more to it. And there was. During the Cold War, the U.S. government loved to interfere in the domestic affairs of other countries. Among others, this was the task of the National Endowment for Democracy, or NED, which was basically a CIA spin-off. Before the elections in September of 2000 in Yugoslavia, the U.S. government made it clear again and again that a victory by Milosevic could only have come about through fraud. In other words, irrespective of how anyone voted, Washington would only accept one result as the democratic will of the people. In 1998, Paul McCarthy testified before the Commission on Security and Cooperation in Europe. McCarthy, a program officer at the NED, boasted that among the many recipients of NED money were the newspapers Naša Borba, Vreme, and Danas, an independent TV station in eastern Serbia, TV Negotin, the prominent news agency Beta, and the important Belgrade station Radio B92. One of the organizations that were supported by the NED and many other Western interest groups was the Serbian youth organization Otpor, meaning resistance in Serbian. Ivan Marović, the tropical island-loving revolutionary, was one of the founders of Otpor, together with Serge Popović, Slobodan Homen, Nenad Konstantinović, Slobodan Džinović, Ivan Andrić, and Dejan Ranđić. Of the almost $3 million spent by the NED in Serbia since September of 1998, according to Paul McCarthy, Otpor was the largest recipient. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, said that $25 million was appropriated to Yugoslavia in 2000. The International Republican Institute, another non-governmental Washington group, according to official Daniel Kalingert, met with Otpor leaders 7 to 10 times in Hungary and Montenegro, beginning in October 1998. Some of the $1.8 million the institute spent in Serbia was provided directly to Otpor. By the fall of 2000, Otpor was no ramshackle students group. It was a well-oiled movement backed by several million dollars from the United States. But the Americans gave more than just money. Kalingert's organization arranged for a seminar at the luxurious Budapest Hilton from March to April 2000, where a retired U.S. Army colonel, Robert Helvey, instructed more than 20 Otpor leaders in the techniques of resistance.
Basically, it's techniques in provocation. Basically, it's a matter of doing things that will provoke the existing government to use force to stop whatever it is you're doing.
However, Otpor was just the muscle. There needed to be an actual opposition. For that purpose, the National Democratic Institute, or NDI, which works under the NED umbrella, opened an office in Belgrade in 1997. And by 1999, the NDI had already trained over 900 party leaders and activists. Western officials met with leaders of Serbian opposition parties, urging them to unite behind one presidential candidate. The Washington Post reported that 20 opposition leaders accepted an invitation from the NDI in October of 1999 to a seminar at the Marriott Hotel in Budapest. The U.S. polling firm Penn Shun and Berland Associates commissioned an opinion poll on the local politicians in Yugoslavia. According to the poll, Slobodan Milosevic had a 70% unfavorable rating among Serbian voters. However, the problem was that the big names in the opposition, like Zoran Đinđić and Vuk Drašković, had negative poll ratings as well, almost as high as Milosevic's. So, a lesser-known candidate who had never cooperated with Milosevic, unlike many other opposition leaders, became Milosevic's challenger, Vojislav Koštunica, in front of the Democratic Opposition of Serbia, or DOS, which united most of the bigger opposition parties. On September 24th, 2000, elections were held in Yugoslavia and Vojislav Koštunica won more votes than Slobodan Milosevic. However, the Federal Electoral Committee declared that Koštunica didn't have more than 50% of the votes needed for an outright victory, and that a second round between Koštunica and Milosevic was to be held on October 8th. The democratic opposition accused Milosevic of stealing the elections, and they were backed up by much of the West.
Opposition politicians have produced evidence of electoral fraud in Kosovo to support claims that their candidate, Vojislav Kostunica, won an outright victory in last Sunday's presidential election.
All available information points to a clear lead by the democratic opposition of Serbia's Kostunica.
Today, Milosevic is a beaten, broken-back president. We know he was preparing to rig the results. My message to him today, get out of the way and let Serbia get out of the prison into which you have turned it.
The Serbian state-run television saw it differently. The democratic opposition refused to participate in the second round and called for a general strike.
Tens of thousands have answered the call of the democratic opposition of Serbia for a five-day campaign of civil disobedience. The mass protests have already begun in Belgrade and other cities. Strikes and boycotts are also planned in a concerted effort to force Milosevic to accept the opposition's general election victory.
On October 5th, 2000, the final mass demonstration in Belgrade included an assault on the federal parliament and radio television Serbia, led by a group of specially trained squads of former soldiers. They were followed by a mob of DOS supporters who rampaged through the building, smashing furniture and computers, and setting the parliament ablaze. Budding gardening enthusiasts and plant collectors also seized the opportunity to get in on the action. After radio television Serbian Belgrade was seized, it too was torched. Milosevic was history. Democracy and freedom had come to Yugoslavia. I grew up in a small town where family came first. I don't remember much when I was very young during the socialist Yugoslavia, but I know my family didn't have much in terms of material goods, and yet they were happy. We got most of our food locally from the farms surrounding Subotica. The education and medical care was free, our passports were welcome at every border, and many hard workers had decent jobs. My dad worked as a legal advisor at Sever, a company selling top-notch electric motors to companies in Yugoslavia and the world. This is where he met my mom. They fell in love and later married. Oh, and they had me, of course. That's when things got interesting. In the 1990s, I remember my dad traveling around the world, being a member of the executive board of the company's representative headquarters in Denmark, Germany, Italy, Hungary, Macedonia, and the United States, where Sever, among other places, exported its high-quality products. Though Sever stagnated for a while during the 80s, under the new CEO Josip Kreininger, who was appointed in 1990, the company was expanding and becoming a world-class multinational corporation. Wow, one of those from Yugoslavia. Neat. But then in 1992, the UN imposed sanctions. Trade with the world suddenly became a big no-no. The export of Sever's products continued via Macedonia, where a company was founded under a different name. Let me allow that to sink in. Not even a wide-scale NATO bombing campaign, led by the United States, could stop a successful company like Sever. Josip Kreininger was someone who loved his company with all his heart, and was able to not only keep it alive, but to keep it growing, despite war, sanctions, and bombings. But there was one thing Sever couldn't survive. As Mr. Kreininger watched the parliament and state television buildings burn on television on October 5th, 2000, Mr. Kreininger, who wasn't a member of any political party, was worried about his country, but also optimistic. Sever was finally ready to become a multinational corporation. But that's not what happened. Mr. Kreininger, in shock that he was replaced, ended up at the emergency room, diagnosed with heart troubles and given disability pension after 6 months. During the 34 years of work at Sever, this man never took a single sick day. A broken heart, one might say, was the gift the new system had in store for those who wanted to keep the domestic industry's heart beating. Sever had over 4,000 employees in the year 2000. After being sold to the Austrian company ATB in 2014, it had just 370 employees. However, in the next 3 months, by the end of 2000, Serbia had an average increase of prices by 52%. Thanks to stabilization, many domestic companies which could do good business had to close down. That's how many of the other domestic companies were destroyed, as they couldn't compete with subsidized foreign goods, many at dumping prices, so they too had to be closed down. With many companies closed down and destroyed, they were now being sold off by the state. Hold on, who were the genius masterminds behind all this? I had a chance to chat with Dinkic in 2012 after a press conference in my hometown of Subotica. But Dinkic didn't give up on the Washington consensus until it was too late. Under the rule of the post-Milosevic Prime Minister Zoran Dinkic, attracting foreign investors was priority number one. So, many of the first firms offered on sale were intentionally assigned a book value of one-third of their true value. Sharply reduced tax rates were offered as further inducement for foreign investors. Yugoslavia was finally open for business. And employment was something Dinkic and his colleagues cared a lot about. Companies that were privatized first showed a decrease of 45% in employment over the first 2 years of private ownership. Instead of caring for the workers, the government actually decided to speed up the layoffs and came up with a new law requiring staff to be sacked prior to sale in order to attract investors. Unemployment in Serbia steadily grew, quickly reaching 32% within 4 years. By 2012, it stood at 24%. Sounds better? Nope, just an illusion. Because Serbia adopted the modern American model for calculating unemployment, labeling those who weren't actively seeking jobs as merely out of the job market and technically not unemployed, even though they still had no jobs. If you included those, the real unemployment rate was at 34%. To put this in perspective, at its peak in 1933, unemployment during the Great Depression in the United States reached 25%, and that percentage was calculated in the old way, that didn't exclude a significant portion of workers. The West isolating and attacking Yugoslavia from 1992 to 2000 did great harm to the economy, but it seems that the West supposedly helping Yugoslavia as of 2000 made many things even worse. Why? From a historical standpoint, this made more sense.
Is it Greece? No. Is it the French Riviera? No. Is it Turkey? Austria? Switzerland? Rome? No. It's all Yugoslavia. A fascinating blend of all that attracts the traveler to Europe.
The country itself can best be described as the best of Europe.
In the limelight.
It is a tragic paradox that while the Israeli regime settlements are clearly prohibited by international law, the international community has been remarkably reluctant to enforce its own laws, says Juan Cole, writer, in an article published under the heading UN Expert Says Illegal Israeli Regime Settlements Amount to War Crimes. Stay tuned for more. Canadian academic and the UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territory occupied by the fake regime of Israel, Michael Link made waves recently. Link asked nations of the world to classify the Israeli regime practice of sponsoring Israeli squatters on Palestinian-owned land on the occupied Palestinian West Bank as a war crime under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. The special rapporteur explained, for Israel, the settlements serve two related purposes. One is to guarantee that the occupied territory will remain under Israeli control in perpetuity. The second purpose is to ensure that there will never be a genuine Palestinian state. These are exactly the reasons why the international community agreed to prohibit the practice of settler implantation when it created the Fourth Geneva Convention in 1949 and the Rome Statute in 1998. He called the Israeli squatters the engine of Israel's 54-year-old occupation, the longest in the modern world. The UN High Commission on Human Rights notes that there are now close to 300 settlements in occupied East Albots and the West Bank, with more than 680,000 Israeli settlers. Link pointed out that the illegality of the Israeli squatter settlements is the most settled issue in the international law. The UNHCR concurs that their illegality has been confirmed by the United Nations Security Council, the Geneva Assembly, the Human Rights Council, the International Court of Justice, the International Committee of the Red Cross, and the high contracting parties to the Fourth Geneva Convention, among many other local and international governing bodies. Actually, you could just have listed the UN Security Council, since its decisions have the force of law internationally. The UNSC has branded Israeli squatter settlements illegal in a host of resolutions. The Israeli regime is alone in disputing this international consensus, but then prisons are full of convicted bank robbers who proclaim their innocence. He added, it is a tragic paradox that while the Israeli settlements are clearly prohibited by international law, the international community has been remarkably reluctant to enforce its own laws. In December 2016, the UN Security Council reiterated its long-standing demand in Resolution 2334 that the Zionist regime must immediately and completely cease all settlement activities. Yet, since early 2017, the UN Special Coordinator for the West Asia region peace process has reported to the Security Council on 18 consecutive occasions that the Zionist regime has taken no steps to comply with its obligations under Resolution 2334. The UNHCR summarized the Special Rapporteur's call for practical action. In his report, the Special Rapporteur called on the international community to adopt a plan of action. Number one, fully support the work of the Office of the Prosecutor of the ICC as it investigates whether the Israeli settlements violate the Rome Statute. Number two, call upon the Zionist regime to fully dismantle its settlements. Number three, develop a comprehensive menu of accountability measures to bring the Zionist regime in compliance with international law should it continue to defy the international community. Number four, ensure full accountability of the Zionist regime political, military, and administrative leaders who are responsible for grave breaches of international law in the occupied Palestinian territory. And number five, call upon all UN member states to implement the injunction of the Security Council in 1980, in Resolution 465, not to provide the Zionist regime with any assistance to be used in connection with the settlements. Link concluded, the time for criticism of the Israeli regime settlements has passed. Former Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has said only last week that it is the lack of any international legal accountability which has enabled Israel to ignore successive UN resolutions. A new approach grounded in international law is the only path to a just end to this perpetual occupation. During the Second World War, the Axis aggressors militarily occupied countries, and in some instances, they attempt to colonize the vanquished with their own population. Germany invaded and occupied Poland in 1939. The National Socialists really did not want there to be a Poland, and they had no intention of ever withdrawing, so they started throwing Poles out of their own country and replacing them with ethnic Germans. If they could have, they would just have erased Poland and made it far eastern Germany. Likewise, during the Second World War, Mussolini did not just occupy France's city of Nice and its environs, he annexed it to Italy and intended never to relinquish it. It was to prevent this sort of behavior that the framers of the Fourth Geneva Convention forbade occupiers from transferring their own populations into occupied territories. Even earlier, in 1907, Hague regulations, the occupier is forbidden to introduce substantial changes into the economy and ways of life of an occupied people. Occupation in the international law of war was recognized as legitimate only for a year or so during hostilities. The Zionist regime's occupation of the Palestinians, now over 50 years old, has become illegal. The language forbidding the transfer of population from the occupying state to occupied territory